Pushkin.
Where do you see your career in 10 years? What are you doing now to help you get there? The sooner you start enhancing your skills, the sooner you'll be ready. That's why AARP has reskilling courses in a variety of categories like marketing and management to help your income live as long as you do. That's right. AARP has a bevy of free skill-building courses for you to choose from because the steps you choose to take today will help you love what you do in the future. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When Mohamed Ashour was in medical school back in 2013, he and a few friends heard about this contest. The team that came up with the best idea for a business to address global food insecurity would win $1 million to launch the business. And like lots of people before them, Mohamed and his friends soon discovered crickets. They learned that crickets are a super efficient machine for turning grain into protein. Quick comparison, a cow eats 8 pounds of grain to make 1 pound of beef. For chicken, the ratio is 2.5 to 1. And for crickets, the ratio is just 1.3 to 1. Incredibly efficient. This is the part of the eating bug story that we've heard before. But the problem always seems to be, how do you get Americans to eat bugs, to eat crickets? Mohamed's big idea was to avoid that problem altogether. Instead, he and his co-founders would bring down the price of crickets for millions of people in other parts of the world where people already eat crickets, but where crickets are not always available or affordable. That turned out to be a surprisingly hard problem to solve, but the idea was enough to win the $1 million prize and launch the business. I'm Jacob Goldstein, and this is What's Your Problem? My guest today is Mohamed Ashour, founder and CEO of Aspire Food Group. The company just built the biggest cricket factory in the history of the world. Mohamed's problem now? How do you sell billions of crickets a year? Today's show is a story about finding your market and also about one of my favorite ideas. An idea that, maybe not surprisingly, has become one of the recurring themes of this podcast. The idea is this. One of the key drivers of human progress is using technology to make things cheaper. In this case, the thing technology is making cheaper is crickets. Bugs.
When we started the business, our goal was not actually, from the get-go, to get North Americans eating bugs. In many of the world's countries, insects are already consumed as a delicious delicacy that is highly nutritious and celebrated. Yeah. But in many of those countries, crickets or other insects are just not available, not affordable, seasonal.
So you want to go to a place where they're a delicacy. I mean, the reason they're a delicacy is because they're expensive, right?
Like exactly.
That's what delicacy means.
And so the idea was we want to now make this a protein source, which is already accepted here, available and affordable year round.
And right? List some of those countries. I mean, I know famously Oaxaca, right? In Mexico. What are some of the other places where people eat crickets?
Oh, gosh. I mean, in Africa alone, you have, Ghana, Nigeria, you have South Africa, you have Niger. If you go to the Middle East, you have Saudi Arabia, you have Kuwait. Like these are places where locusts are widely consumed. If you go to Asia, you have some of the countries like Thailand and Vietnam. And
okay.
Now, it's not in every one of these countries, there are certain, cities or municipalities or areas where insects are widely consumed because of their geography or their climate, and others less so. But fundamentally is a very large percentage of the world's countries that have some history of consuming insects.
So what you want for your mission really is a place where lots of people are hungry, struggle to have enough food, and where eating crickets is already normal.
Exactly. That's right. And that was our focus from the beginning.
And so if that was the focus, why not build the factory there?
Yeah. So one of the challenges we faced is we actually tried. So when we first started the company, one of my co-founders moved to Ghana, and one of us moved to Oaxaca, Mexico, and I moved to Austin, Texas, where we were starting to pilot cricket farming. And the challenges we faced is both the talent that you needed to have placed there in order to build the capability, not just the engineering talent, but also the entomology talent and the understanding of how to grow those insects at scale. And the agricultural requirements, the regulatory requirements, a lot of factors were very challenging to be able to pull off for a bunch of like expat foreign students.
Okay. So you tried. So the answer is you tried.
Mm-hmm. And the answer is
too hard to, yeah.
Yeah, for us as a founding team, given our specific circumstances and given some of the realities we were experiencing at the time. Now, when we decided, okay, well, we're going to produce crickets in North America and, you know, focus perhaps on shipping overseas to some of these markets, that's when we also started to see this opportunity. And part of this was driven by inbound requests. So back in 2015, right around when we built our factory in Austin, our very first facility, there was a bunch of startups that were getting funding on like Shark Tank and a whole bunch of others that were getting, you know, funded on Kickstarter very successfully that were making, you know, protein bars from crickets or other snacks from crickets that were reaching out to us, asking us if we can supply them.
So, okay, you realize you aren't going to be able to build a factory somewhere people already eat crickets. You're thinking maybe you'll ship them there, but you also think, well, you got the crickets anyways. People are kind of into crickets in the US right now. And you actually try this sort of plan B move where you sell bags of crickets like chips in the US, right? Tell me about that.
So the idea was simple. It was to try to go on one side where you are so explicit about the fact that this is a cricket that you actually present it as a snack in whole cricket form, right? Uh-huh. So you take these crickets, you roast them, you apply seasoning, like, you know, it's like chip seasoning, right? Like barbecue or sour cream or whatever. And they would be consumed not dissimilarly to something like jerky in the sense that it's a very meaty, high protein snack that is savory. And it was very interesting to see the response we got because you sort of had like a certain percentage, and I would say it's a small but extremely dedicated, you know, very devoted following of people who found this to be super nutritious and delicious. But of course, and
people
also
who made it like their whole identity, like, hey, call me Cricket. I'm the cricket guy. I love to snack on crickets. Ask me about crickets.
Yeah. That's right. And they were remarkably popular amongst children in particular. Huh. And then you had, on the flip side, I would say a much larger percentage of people whom that was too much in terms of like just visually seeing a cricket and being able to pick it up and eat it.
Yeah, I don't want to eat a bug. Seems like not that surprising response.
Yeah.
So at this point, like plan A, build a factory where people already eat crickets. That didn't work. Plan B, sell crickets to people in North America. That's not going great. But then there's this moment when you kind of get your big break. Tell me about that.
We were actually at a food show in Anaheim, California.
Okay.
We had at the time a large company that primarily focuses on pet food looking for human grade ingredients.
Uh-huh. So they could sell some premium thing like give your dog chicken that's as good as the chicken you eat, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And that led to was this unbelievable rabbit hole where we became to understand that over the last decade or so, there has been two major trends in pet food. The first has been the humanization of pets. Pets are no longer this furry thing that greets you and makes you feel good. It is a member of the household, and in most households, the favorite child.
Yeah.
And as a result, when that's your philosophy, that means you feed and clothe your pets accordingly.
Yeah.
And the amount of money that people are spending on their pets is staggering. And by the way, pets represent about 1 in 4 calories consumed when it comes to animal products in North America.
So just to be clear, 25% of the meat calories being consumed in North America is consumed by pets.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's go back to Anaheim. So you're talking to some pet food company.
Yes. And they come to us and they start asking us about, you know, this cricket protein and, you know, what are we feeding? Is this human grade? Oh, yes, it is. Okay, well, tell us about sustainability. And we start describing the sustainability benefits and their eyes just flash. And they start describing to us the challenges their customers are facing, because they're sort of in a moral, an ethical dilemma that a lot of their customers face, who are mostly millennials, the largest pet owning demographic by far, face this dilemma where on the one hand, they want to feed their pets like they're humans, and that's benevolent, but then most of what they have to choose from to feed their pets is not very environmentally or ecologically healthy. Right. And that's the other thing too. Dogs are, you know, omnivores that preferentially consume meat in their diet, and cats are carnivores.
Yeah.
So there's also a challenge with just using purely plant-based or vegetable-based.
Yeah, right. You know, if you're like a center-left millennial, you want to do the right thing for your pet and do the right thing for the earth, what do you do?
Exactly. Yeah. And so this was the opportunity. Now, the next question this customer asked me is, well, how, what's your volume today? We're very interested.
This customer is a big pet food company?
Yes, that's right. And well, and they also manufacture and distribute to other pet food companies as well.
Okay.
So they ask us, you know, what's your production volume today? We said, well, our production volume today is, you know, maybe low hundreds of thousands of pounds a year. They said, oh, okay, well, that's too bad. We said, well, why? Why is it too bad? They said, you know, the guy said to me, he's like, Mohammed, you're not going to be able to move the needle in the pet food market unless you get to £1 million a month or more. Because the demand is very significant, and the production, the way you produce in terms of like the kibble, et cetera, is always done at significant scale. And my customers, even if they do a test launch in just one market, that's like millions of pounds of required product.
Yeah.
So of course I immediately said to that person, I said, well, listen, there's like clearly a value and a philosophical alignment between, you know, the market you represent and our mission as a company. So, I mean, if we were to have the resources and capacity to scale to meet that volume, is that something you would commit to? And they said, we would sign today, you know, a commitment if you were able to meet that volume and if you were to meet that demand. And in fact, that is what led to us being able, now with this significant demand in hand, we were able to justify building a commercial facility that can lead to us meeting that market.
So you're going to sell billions of crickets a year for pet food starting in the next year or so.
Yeah, exactly.
When are the first crickets going to go out the door of your factory headed for a pet food factory?
In 3 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can you say what pet food company is buying crickets?
You'll find out very soon.
Okay. I mean, the only pet food company I've heard of is Purina. So I'll just say, is it Purina?
No comment.
Okay. Interesting.
And it's not just one. It's not just one pet food brand, by the way.
So, okay, Plan C, this pet food idea seems promising for a few reasons. One is pets eat a lot of meat, which I didn't even really think about much until I had this conversation with Mom. So there's a real environmental problem to solve here, and also, bugs are clearly not gross to most of the dogs and cats I have known, at least. Like, if my dog found a cricket on the sidewalk, he'd eat it. But now that Mohammed has found his cricket demand, he has to come up with the cricket supply. Coming up after the break, how do you build the biggest, most high-tech cricket factory in the history of the world? You probably think it's too soon to join AARP, right? Well, let's take a minute to talk about it. Where do you see yourself in 15 years? More specifically, your career, your health, your social life. What are you doing now to help you get there? There are tons of ways for you to start preparing today for your future with AARP. That dream job you've dreamt about? Sign up for AARP reskilling courses to help make it a reality. How about that active lifestyle you've only spoken about from the couch? AARP has health tips and wellness tools to keep you moving for years to come. But none of these experiences are without making friends along the way. Connect with your community through AARP volunteer events. So it's safe to say it's never too soon to join AARP. They're here to help your money, health, and happiness live as long as you do. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/wisefriend.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is Accelerating Innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Now, back to the show. Earlier this year, Mohammed and his colleagues opened a giant cricket factory in London, Ontario, Canada. From the outside, the factory just looks like a big white industrial building. And on the inside, to a large extent, it also looks like a big industrial building. You know, think of like robots moving around pallets with big plastic bins on them. But inside each bin is tens of thousands of live crickets. Is it loud when you go to where the crickets are? Is it loud?
Not yet. You know, we expect that once we get to full production capacity, you'll have a nice sort of comforting, soothing chorus of chirping. Actually, a group of crickets is called an orchestra, which is why we've named our facility here an orchestra.
Okay. Tell me about the place where you're sitting right now. Where are you talking to me from?
Our facility is 150,000 square foot, mostly factory with a, you know, a headquarter office component. And it is the world's largest fully automated cricket production facility.
Largest fully automated. So does that mean there's a bigger, not fully automated cricket production facility?
No, it doesn't. This is just a very comprehensive description. It is the largest cricket farm, and it also holds the record of largest automated cricket farm, and also holds the world record for.
So you're talking to me from the biggest cricket farm ever in the history of the universe.
Well, I don't know about the universe, but certainly planet
Fair.
Earth.
Fair. Good. Good point. And when did it open?
And we began production this past month.
Cricket number one arrived this month.
Correct.
And when are you going to get to cricket, whatever, 1 billion?
Yeah, later this year, towards the end of the year.
Okay. Just because the crickets have to make more crickets? Is that what has
to happen? That's right. That's right. So a single female will lay somewhere between 100 to 200 eggs per week. The reproductivity of the crickets is pretty remarkable, and the rate at which we will grow will be quite exponential.
So let's talk about this factory. Like, are there sort of tricks or efficiencies you're gaining, or is it just more crickets? You know, you can 10x the amount of crickets and you don't have to 10x the amount of staff, and therefore it's just basic, simple economy of scale.
There's a combination of the two.
Let's do this. Tell me the story at this new fancy, biggest ever cricket factory you have. Like, start with what? An egg? Is that the right place to start?
Yeah.
If we start with an egg, or maybe with the mother laying an egg, wherever you want to start. Start at the beginning and end with somebody eating cricket.
Sure.
How does that story go?
Yeah, so sure. So the way it works is you have our breeder totes. So we have these bins in the facility that are dedicated to crickets that are sexually mature and will mate. And then effectively the females will deposit their eggs into a substrate. That substrate will be incubated.
Wait,
and then
just
the eggs.
Slow down a little. I want to slow down a little bit. So you have a breeder, you called it a tote?
Like, yes.
What
so
is that?
Think of it as a bin the size of a pallet. Okay, so
okay,
it's
a pallet, like a shipping
box.
Pallet.
Yeah, like a shipping, a box that's a pretty large box, the size of a pallet. And that's the single unit that we move around in the building. Think of that as like the housing unit for a certain population of crickets multiplied by, you know, many thousands of these totes in the facility. Okay. And the total of that is the total population of crickets in the building.
So your crickets live in these boxes. And so you have some with crickets that are breeding.
Mm-hmm.
And they lay eggs.
Yeah. And they lay eggs. And then those eggs are incubated and then they hatch. The newly hatched crickets are called pinheads. And that's because they are so small, they could literally fit on the tip of a pen.
Okay. How many crickets grow up in a bin?
Yeah, approximately 30,000 are in each bin.
30,000. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And those bins will now have food and water and all of the requirements that the crickets are going to need for the 30-day period in which they are going to be housed in this this facility until they are ready to be harvested. So in other words, you're putting everything the crickets need that is fully sufficient for that 30-day period. You're sealing and closing the lid and effectively not touching or interfering with or in any way interrupting this process for 30 days. You come at the end of 30 days, and in that 30 days, crickets grow about 800 times their body weight. That's the equivalent of a human baby growing to become a T-Rex in 30 days. Okay. So you have at the end of 30 days now these crickets that have reached adult size, and you harvest them. Okay. The way we harvest the crickets is we actually freeze them.
So, okay, that's the process of how you raise the crickets. And the point of building this big factory and of using the plastic totes and everything else is to bring down the cost of crickets, right? So let's talk about cost. What does a pound of crickets cost?
Yeah, sure. So typically speaking, crickets are purchased as either a powder or in like a raw material form. A powder, in powder form, that it would take about, let's say, 4 pounds of crickets to produce 1 pound of cricket powder, right? Okay. So today, a pound of cricket powder will sell for about, call it somewhere between $15 to $20 per pound of powder.
Okay. Okay. So if it's 4 pounds of crickets to make that powder, that means even just a pound of plain crickets is still more expensive than a pound of like chicken.
Absolutely. And that price is largely based on the scale challenge that this industry has had. Yeah. Now, as you scale up and you introduce more automation, your cost per unit of production starts to dramatically drop. And the more you scale, the more efficient your costs are over time. So for us, the premise always has been that if you look at the math, like on paper, if crickets use less land, less water, less energy, less food, then really, the inputs that are typically the largest driver of cost when it comes to livestock production, if they are much lower for crickets, then therefore crickets should be much less expensive. It's pretty simple math. The reason they're not is because the scale at which you're producing crickets today is so small and your labor cost per unit is so high that obviously your price is quite significant. This is why this facility that we've just built is such a massive step, because we are going to be able to dramatically increase the affordability of our crickets within the next 12 months. And to put that in perspective, you know, if a pound of cricket powder today sells for about $20, within the next 12 months, it'll drop below $10. And we anticipate that within the next 3 to 5 years, we will actually be close to the $5 per pound mark.
You seem confident in those predictions. So you're saying the price a year from now is going to be half what it is today?
Yes.
How do you know?
How do I know? The reason I know is because you look at what is driving the cost today of $20 per pound.
Because you know your cost.
Yeah, I know my cost granularly.
So there's two reasons you're expecting the price of crickets to fall in half in the next year, and what, in half again a few years after that, basically? Mm-hmm. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I understand it, one is just scale. You just have mm-hmm. a really big factory now, and it's more efficient, fewer dollars of labor per cricket. Mm-hmm. Two, you're just getting better at raising crickets. You're figuring out how to be more efficient. Is that right?
Yes, we will be gathering about 30 million data points every single day on everything like temperature, humidity, light intensity, sound pressure, and understanding how each one of those things maps to growth. So if I see a certain cluster of totes bins in my facility that I see a 5% increase in yield compared to a different control, and I look at the underlying data and what was actually happening in each bin, I know what is happening in each bin because I'm capturing that data, and B, yeah, I can look at the nuances of what those differences are and then immediately set that new baseline. When we first started, I think we were getting, so out of 30,000 crickets, we were getting maybe something like 2 pounds of yield.
You got a box full of crickets, a box of 30,000
yeah.
crickets.
30,000 baby pinhead crickets, and by the end of a month, you get 2 pounds.
Okay.
Now we're close to 20 pounds per bin.
Wow.
And that's 5 years.
10 times.
Yes.
And is it because more of the crickets are surviving now? Is it because they're bigger? Is it something else?
A combination of the above. So figuring out, for example, what is the optimal feed? Where do you ideally place the feed? Because a pinhead cricket is so small. So even like the particle size of the feed matters. If you have your feed is not crushed into a certain particle size, it may be difficult for the crickets to eat it. Water access, right? When you have a cricket the size of the tip of a pen, it can literally drown in a drop of water. So how do you ensure that it can drink water in that very fragile state in its early days and still be able to access water when it gets older and larger? And how do you optimize the number of crickets per bin?
What's the answer to the water one? How do you do that?
That's a trade secret.
Is it really? Is it a cricket trade secret?
It actually is a cricket trade secret. Yep.
So like, can you tell me what's going on inside the bin, or it's like, that's a literal black box?
It is in many ways a black box, because that's ultimately, when you think about all of the intellectual property of the company, it kind of comes down to not just what you have in the bin and where it's placed, but also what are the decisions around how you've done that. So I think if you look at the major difference between what we've done and what we've learned compared to virtually any other cricket farming operation in the world, and there is quite a few, the difference is we are the only cricket farming operation that has devised a successful way of farming crickets in a fully enclosed bin. And that allows you to do so many interesting things. Now you can stack the bins. Now you can have a lot more efficient packing in your facility, the way you're moving it around.
And presumably it makes it super scalable, because you just close the box and go away for a month and come back.
Exactly. And also the other aspect of scale that is crucial is, you know, a lot of startups, I think, get too hung up on IP in the early days, right? Because you have to kind of put your elbows out and prove why you're different, why you're so special, specifically if you want to attract investor dollars. But as you grow up as a company and you want to scale up, actually, it becomes a disadvantage for too many things to be custom, because it's very hard to modularize. It's very hard to scale. Ideally, in our case, when we focused all of our IP on what's happening inside the bin, now we can make everything else off the shelf, right? The factory conveying systems are off the shelf, because the unit of the bin is a pallet. And we universally know how to move pallets around inside warehouses, inside factories. So that allows you to take advantage of so many already proven, de-risk technologies, and to focus your core competency on the thing you know best, which is what's actually happening inside these bins.
So in a sense, outside the bin, it's just a generic factory, and you can use all the generic factory technology that already exists.
Yeah, it's a super, super cool factory. Hopefully you'll visit one day.
Like, and robots? You got like robots driving them around? Lots of robotics,
factory conveyance that's fully automated, sensors, computer vision, that sort of thing.
So you had this original idea of basically bringing down the price of crickets for people in places where people already eat crickets. You still working on that?
Yes, 100%. So for us, that's the North Compass. The problem we found when we did the math in the early days is to profitably sell crickets to a single mother of three children in Kumasi, Ghana, you have to have an unbelievably tight operating cost structure. And we're not even there yet with this facility. So my view and my vision long-term is that within the next 5 years, we will finally hit the cost floor that allows us to now be able to build a facility at scale in the Middle East, in Africa, to actually meet the demand in some of these markets. And what's really heartening is we actually received an investment at the end of last year from a fairly large Korean food and beverage company that is interested in building out a factory in Korea that distributes to many parts of Asia, and where the ultimate objective there is to address food security and to meet the nutrition requirements of populations, but profitably doing so. And that's when we began to drip.
And how much does the cost of cricket production have to fall for it to be a real, protein food source for people in the developing world?
I would say it would have to drop another 30 to 40% from where we are today.
Okay. And how long is it going to take you to do that?
I am optimistic within the next 5 years we'll be there.
I love it when stuff gets cheaper. In a minute, the lightning round. We have lots of questions about bugs.
You probably think it's too soon to join AARP, right? Well, let's take a minute to talk about it. Where do you see yourself in 15 years? More specifically, your career, your health, your social life. What are you doing now to help you get there? There are tons of ways for you to start preparing today for your future with AARP. That dream job you've dreamt about? Sign up for AARP reskilling courses to help make it a reality. How about that active lifestyle you've only spoken about from the couch? AARP has health tips and wellness tools to keep you moving for years to come. But none of these experiences are without making friends along the way. Connect with your community through AARP volunteer events. So it's safe to say it's never too soon to join AARP. They're here to help your money, health, and happiness live as long as you do. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/wisefriend.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than they're worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
That's the end of the ads. Now we're going back to the show. Let's do a lightning round. Let's just do some fast questions. Okay, indeed.
First insect I ate.
Sure. You want to do that one? You can ask me. Sure. How about when was the last time you ate an insect?
This weekend. Cricket powder in my pancake mix with kids.
Does it even taste different, or is it just like pancakes with protein?
It doesn't taste any different. Crickets taste like what they eat. And so you have this very, very kind of mild flavor that's kind of corn in its odor and texture, and you blend it with flour, you can't tell any difference.
Are you tired of the sound crickets make?
No, I'm not.
You like it? You like it still?
Yeah, it's soothing.
Can you
do
the sound? Can you make it?
I can't. No. And if I did, it would not be soothing.
It's really hard, right? What do you think is the most underrated insect?
I'd probably say ants. I think bees get a lot of credit. But ants have an unbelievable role they play ecologically to sustain our ecosystems. And I'm just amazed at how powerful they are relative to their body size.
And the way they can act in concert, right? The way they can act.
In concert. Yeah. As a team, the teamwork is just, for me personally, I can't get enough of ants.
What's your second favorite insect after crickets?
I really enjoyed palm weevil larvae in Ghana. Very tasty.
How do you just eat them? How do you eat them?
It's like you skewer them on a shish kebab, and then you consume it no differently than you would like a chicken shish kebab or a beef. Like you add it to a stew or rice or with a pita bread or something like that, or jollof rice in that case. It was very tasty.
If everything goes well, what's a problem you'll be trying to solve in 5 years?
There's over 1 million species of insects in the world that have been identified. And I believe every insect is a source of some natural superpower raw material. We've happened to match crickets to protein. We know that honey's in bee and silkworms in silk. Imagine all the other raw materials and all the other insects that are yet to be discovered once you know how to produce them at scale.
Well, give me one or two that are on your short list then.
Like, I'll tell you what, there's a specific species of insect that has been shown and has shown very promising potential to actually biodegrade PET plastic. In other words, it literally eats plastic and produces glycol on the other end. That's very exciting.
Mohamed Ashour is the co-founder and CEO of Aspire. Today's show was produced by Edith Russolo, engineered by Amanda K. Wong, and edited by Robert Smith. I'm Jacob Goldstein, and we'll be back next week with another episode of What's Your Problem? How do you create present and future value? As a leading provider of specialized finance, operations, and technology advisory services for Fortune 500 companies, emerging growth market leaders, and private equity sponsors, Cross Country Consulting solves today's most pressing challenges and creates present and future enterprise value. With tailored integrated solutions for accounting, risk, technology-enabled transformation, and transaction solutions, Cross Country works as a strategic partner and collaborative part of your team. The future-ready business, in sight and within reach. Go to crosscountry-consulting.com to learn more. If you're looking for a new podcast but don't know where to start, here's one you can add to your list. The Jordan Harbinger Show. The Jordan Harbinger Show is aimed at making you a better informed critical thinker so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusions about what's happening. Jordan talks to everyone from neuroscientists to CEOs to astronauts, authors, and performers. You might enjoy Jordan's interview with historian Yuval Noah Harari, the author of Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, or his episode with Fool Me Once author Kelly Richmond Pope on how fraud became a trillion-dollar industry. Whether Jordan's conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you'll find something useful that you can apply to your own life in every episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or it could just be discovering a slight mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show, that's H-A-R-B-I-N-G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to podcasts.